Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
Welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. I'm Barbara Grubon. Coming up on the program this week, European leaders try to put their differences aside to bring peace in Lebanon. We'll look at the growing anti-Western backlash in Turkey, ask if the ecosystem of the Baltic Sea is on the verge of collapse, and we'll visit a medieval festival in the heart of Transylvania. Those stories and more coming up on the program. The conflict in Lebanon between Israel and Hezbollah and the humanitarian crisis unfolding there have caused widespread public consternation in Europe. But governments are divided over what should happen next. The EU is split between those who feel that Israel is largely to blame for the carnage and those that feel the country's quite properly defending itself against terrorism. Deutsche Welle's Stephen Beard reports.
With the death toll rising sharply in Lebanon, the EU's External Affairs Council met to formulate a common response to the crisis. The Finnish Foreign Minister, Erkki Tuomioja, delivered what he said was a clear message from the community to the combatants in the Middle East.
The Council calls for an immediate cessation of hostilities to be followed by a sustainable ceasefire.
And this, he insisted, was the unanimous view of all 25 member states of the European Union.
I can affirm that there are no divisions in the European Union.
That raised a few eyebrows. The Council's communique was in fact a compromise, bridging a large gap between some of the EU's key member states. France has openly called for an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon, while Britain has backed the American line, refusing to endorse that call, arguing that it treats Israel and Hezbollah as equal. The German government agreed. Here's Erhard von Kleiden, foreign affairs spokesman for the CDU party.
We see that the main reason for this conflict are the attacks on Israel by the Hezbollah.
While many newspapers and some leading politicians across the EU have been critical of Israel, the governments of Germany, Britain, Poland and the Czech Republic have been supportive. Britain's Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett explicitly refused to describe the Israeli military action as disproportionate.
If those who have the responsibility of trying to get a movement forward use words that are felt to put them in a place where it shows you don't really understand our problem, people stop listening. And we cannot afford for Israel to stop listening.
But reflecting the divisions in Europe, there are deep divisions within the British government as well. Jack Straw, another member of the cabinet, himself a former foreign secretary, has described the Israeli military action as disproportionate and excessive. His parliamentary aide is Paddy Tipping.
I think Jack Straw is keen to reflect a strong view in the Labour Party and the country as a whole and internationally that the Israeli response has not been proportionate.
There have been rumblings of protest throughout Britain's ruling Labour Party. Joan Ruddock, a former minister, has condemned Israel's response.
You cannot solve a problem of terrorism of this kind by massive military force. Israel will not succeed, will make more enemies. They will regroup. Hezbollah will possibly become stronger. And this is not the way to solve this kind of problem.
And, she says, Tony Blair's refusal to criticise Israeli actions or push harder for an immediate ceasefire have alienated much of his own party.
I have not met any member of the Labour Party myself who actually agrees with our strategy.
With his personal approval ratings at an all-time low, Tony Blair was already under mounting pressure from within his party to resign and leave office. The crisis over Lebanon could well hasten his departure.
Stephen Beard reporting there. And as we just heard, European foreign ministers met for an emergency meeting in Brussels this week to discuss at length if and how the European Union should call for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. I spoke with our Network Europe Brussels correspondent, Stephen Castle, and asked him how successful the meeting was.
Well, I think we'd have to say that it was only really a limited success because at the end of the day, the main European countries are not completely united in their view on what precisely to do about the terrible conflict in the Middle East. It was Britain who basically led the opposition to a call for an immediate ceasefire. But Britain was backed by Germany, Poland and the Czech Republic, so it wasn't completely isolated. And at the end of the day, the EU member states managed to produce a declaration, but it wasn't significantly more detailed, wasn't significantly different, in fact, from the declaration that emerged from Rome the previous week. So when the extraordinary meeting of the foreign affairs was completed, there were, in fact, quite a number of questions about the Finnish presidency, why they had, in fact, called this meeting when there clearly wasn't going to be unanimity.
France was one of the strongest advocates of an immediate ceasefire. Germany, though, has distanced itself from Paris, saying a cessation of hostilities is not the same. How did you read Germany's position?
Well, I think Germany's position is quite interesting. It's a nuanced position between the French position and the British position. And this, in fact, is somewhat typical of Chancellor Merkel. I think one also has to remember that Germany has a special relationship with Israel for historical reasons. It doesn't want to rush in and be seen to put a lot of pressure on Israel, which would be unwelcome in Tel Aviv at the moment. On the other hand, it has to take a balanced position because of its own public opinion. So I think the German position is extremely interesting, but it is notably independent of that of France. Germany's taken a slightly different position on Syria and on Iran. Germany suggested that Syria might be an interlocutor in resolving this conflict, whereas the French have gone out on a limb slightly and suggested that Iran might be an interlocutor.
Now, what impact do these divisions have for the credibility of the European Union?
Well, I think the European Union has an opportunity here because for the first time that I can remember, Israel has indicated that it probably would welcome an international force led by European soldiers in the Middle East, in southern Lebanon. So this is a real opportunity for the EU to show that its growing economic power can be mirrored on the global stage in terms of its diplomatic and military influence. The problem, of course, is getting unity, and this is always the problem in the EU. You have 25 member states now, quite clear divisions quite often, and I think Europe's credibility is going to be judged by whether or not it can ultimately get agreement on an international peacekeeping force and what its mandate should be, and that isn't quite evident yet.
France has been mentioned as a leader of a possible new international force in the region. Italy, Spain, Slovakia, Sweden and Denmark have said they're willing to provide troops as well. Does the EU feel it's in the best position to contribute and lead such an international force?
I think the EU does feel that in some formation, at any rate, it is going to be very, very prominent in this international peacekeeping force. I mean, NATO was one option, but because of the US domination of NATO, it's seen in the region as a rather difficult element to add to this rather combustible mix, having NATO there. So I think there will be a very strong European dimension to it. Whether or not it is an EU mission remains to be seen. I think the French, for example, who will probably want to lead this mission, would like, for example, Turkey, which is an applicant country now, negotiating for EU membership, to be prominent in the force. And that, of course, would give a component of non-Christian Muslim soldiers there.
Network Europe's Brussels correspondent Stephen Castle. The United Nations and the European Union may well turn to Turkey to participate in the formation of a peacekeeping force for southern Lebanon. However, despite Turkey's political importance, the latest Eurobarometer survey indicates that almost half of all Europeans are against Turkey joining the European Union. There are, however, wide discrepancies between member states. More than 80% of Austrians are hostile to Turkish EU membership, closely followed by over 60% of Germans and Luxembourgers, Cypriots and Greeks, while only 23% in Spain are against the idea of Turks joining the Union. But how is the mood in Turkey, and how do Turks feel about joining the European Union? It now seems support for EU membership is dwindling rapidly. For the first time, according to a recent Turkish poll, supporters of EU entry are now a minority. That's a change from last year, when Turkey was given a firm date to start accession talks, and more than 70% of Turks were in favour of joining. So why do Turks no longer see the European Union as an attractive El Dorado? Radio France International's Nick Champeau traveled to Turkey to find out.
I first headed to the European Information Center near Istanbul's Taksim Square. I was hoping to have a chat with visitors there about their feelings towards the EU, but the center was empty. However, I did meet an EU information officer. She wasn't alarmed by the declining figures. She told me that the closer candidate countries get to membership, the more support drops. It's a classic scenario, she said, without giving me other reasons. So I went to the bustling Istiklal High Street. That's where I met 35-year-old Mustafa. He was standing in front of the Italian Benetton clothes shop. He has worked as an internet consultant in Britain and Sweden. He's helping Western companies penetrate the Turkish internet market. Mustafa says Turkey does not need the EU to attract investors.
Before European Union accepts the interests of Turkey, I think the multinational companies will be here, well implanted. The business world is always one step ahead of the politicians.
And do you think that Turkey will eventually join the EU?
Well, to be honest, I hope not.
Why?
Well, because I think that Europeans are not sincere. They are afraid to lose Turkey and they are afraid to take Turkey. So I think it's a kind of dishonoring. I would rather have a partnership with America. They don't have double standards.
Turkish people often accuse Brussels of double standards. Ingvil is a 21-year-old student.
We're wasting our time with the EU. They're taking us for a ride, using excuses such as Cyprus to stop us from joining. Croatia was supposed to begin accession talks after us, and now Croatia is well ahead. They're afraid of us because we're a large Muslim nation. They're afraid of Islam. They think we're fundamentalists, but it's not true.
Ingvil is partly right. Religion is an issue, and the decades-old Cyprus dispute has indeed poisoned membership talks with Turkey. Yashar Yakish is an MP and president of the European Affairs Commission at the Turkish Parliament in Ankara.
If the European Union does not want to accept Turkey, then they can use the Cyprus question is an excellent excuse not to do so. This was actually the position of the European Union since a long time, to hide behind the Cypriot element. If we give away Cyprus, they will find other excuses.
Yashar Yakish is member of the Islamic Justice and Development Party, which won a landslide victory in the 2002 elections. The opposition says the party is doing little to emphasize the advantages of joining the EU because it's too busy building mosques and transferring capital from secular to religious circles. And commentators say that the wind of religious conservatism is driving Turkish Muslims away from Brussels. Amani is a 29-year-old engineer. She says the prospect of EU membership is attractive, but Islam comes first.
If they're going to change themselves just to join this union, I think they shouldn't, because they have special characteristics. What I'm saying that they have good points from the European side, and they have another good points from the Islamic side, because they cannot deny this fact. Almost more than 90% of their Turkish people are Muslims.
Another issue that is putting Turkish people off: they were insulted when Paris introduced constitutional changes regarding enlargement last year. French President Jacques Chirac is the only French center-right politician who supports Turkey's EU membership. But he is also aware of the fact that enlargement fatigue has struck a majority of the French population. That's why in 2005 he changed the constitution to enable French people to have the last word. They will decide in a referendum. Verena Knaus is a senior analyst with the European Stability Initiative, a think tank based in Istanbul. She says this has sent a negative signal to Turks.
The feeling has always been, and the strength of the European Union in the past has been, that it's a question of fulfilling criteria, which are clear. So the Copenhagen criteria have to be fulfilled by all member states, the economic criteria have to be fulfilled, and the 33 chapters of the acquis communautaire have to be fulfilled. And now, suddenly, it seems that it's no longer based on merits. that it doesn't matter what reforms Turkey will go through, it will in the end depend on the public opinion and maybe on a domestic political debate in France whether Turkey can really join the club or not.
Turkish politicians often insist on the fact that they're introducing reforms first and foremost for the sake of their country and not to please Brussels. At the same time, the country's foreign affairs minister, Abdoulaye Gül, says Brussels should bear in mind that Turkey, as a European-style democracy, should be seen as a major contribution to world and European peace. An argument that may have gained weight since the current war erupted between Israel and Lebanon. Istanbul, Nick Champeau, RFI.
Over to Scandinavia now, where media has been awash with reports lately pointing to doomsday scenarios about the Baltic Sea. With the ever-growing problem of algae, mounting death of fish, and risk of biological collapse, we're constantly reminded that it's simply a matter of time before the entire ecosystem falls apart. Last week, the European Commission adopted a proposal to save cod stocks in the Baltic Sea. And later this month, the Baltic Sea Conference will host talks to discuss the excessive use of fertilizers and the types of pollution confronting the Baltic Sea. Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros has a closer look at the poor state of health of the Baltic Sea.
To understand the problem, you first need to know that the Baltic Sea is an enclosed area with a low salinity, with a mixture of freshwater and marine water, and also that the exchange rate of the water in the Baltic Sea is very low and very slow. And the area around the Baltic Sea is inhabited by 85 million people, so it's also a very polluted area.
Bartil Widbom teaches at the University of the Swedish Baltic Island of Gotland. The Baltic Sea is described as one of the filthiest seas on this planet, so much so that many scientists and environmentalists wonder if it is not on the verge of collapse. What are the main causes of the environmental problems faced by the Baltic Sea? Klas Hjelm of the Swedish Society for the Conservation of Nature.
One is hazardous substances or environmental toxic substances which contaminated the Baltic for many years. Even if we have been able to reduce some of the amounts, other new toxics come up. So that's still a very important problem to follow.
The problem lies further out deep in the sea, where marine life has been particularly affected. The deep of the Baltic Sea is so polluted that experts wonder if it has not already flipped. That still is a bone of contention, but how worried should we be? Lena Sommerstad is Sweden's Minister for the Environment.
I'm very worried because we now know that it might be an ecosystem collapse in the Baltic Sea. The Baltic Sea is a very sensitive sea, a particularly sensitive sea, because it's brackish water. It's also a very slow change of water in the Baltic Sea, so it's more sensitive than other seas in Europe. So we have every reason to be worried.
A major problem that more and more of the researchers beginning to realize is that the Baltic Sea seems to have come into a new steady state where it's eutrophying itself. The eutrophication has made the plankton organisms, high amounts of plankton organisms that are sedimentating to the bottom, and when they are broken down, that takes oxygen, and that oxygen is not replaced in any other way that there is salt water inflow coming from the North Sea. And the events of salt water inflows have become much less frequent since the early 80s. And that in connection also with that the load of organic matter from above makes that about one-third of the bottom area of the Baltic Sea is without oxygen today.
Overfishing is another major problem faced by the Baltic Sea. Some fish species, such as the cod, are on the verge of extinction, and urgent measures are needed to arrest the development.
Due to too high fisheries pressures during many years, we have very, very low amounts of some of the most important fish species, for instance, the cod, which is close to maybe a real collapse in the Baltic Sea. You have to, together with other states around the Baltic, reduce the press from the fisheries to start rebuild of the cod, for instance, population, other fish species as well.
Another problem facing the Baltic Sea is caused by marine transport. And the transport of oil over the sea also could result in environmental damages of enormous magnitude. Russia uses the sea to transport its oil, and that is not without its dangers, says Environment Minister Lena Sommerstad, since Russia regards the Baltic Sea as one of its main oil transport channels.
Because for Russia, the Baltic Sea is above all a transport path for their ships, and they have increased their shipments very much of oil in particular in recent years. We do have an increasingly good cooperation, though. For example, on rescue operations, we cooperate a lot on this. We have got understanding from Russia when it comes to better construction of their ships. But we do have, of course, opposite interests here, because it's very important for Russia to use the Baltic Sea to transport oil in particular.
So how can the Baltic Sea be saved? What needs to be done?
What we try to do, the Swedish Society for Nature Conservation, is to raise public opinion, get more press on the politicians, and we come up with different proposals that we try to influence the politicians on. So, and we also try to cooperate with our neighboring countries and the different organizations we have around the Baltic.
But why have the countries around the Baltic Sea found it difficult to agree on a binding common strategy to save the sea from collapsing?
Because up to now, we haven't had any convention with binding rules. We've had the Helsinki Convention, where we've had recommendations. Now we have a very good opportunity to do this within the European Union, to have binding rules for the Baltic Sea. And I'm very anxious to get these binding rules.
How hopeful are you that you'll be able to find the necessary support among member states?
I'm not that optimistic, because we have seen that many countries are still hesitant. We have got a proposal from the Commission that is not very ambitious. It does have a directive, and I'm very pleased that it has a directive, but the time plan, above all, is very weak. So we've had to push this very strongly in negotiations now.
Lena Sommerstad, Sweden's Minister for the Environment, speaking to Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros about the problems facing the Baltic Sea. Sighișoara, a small town in the heart of Transylvania, is one of Europe's best preserved medieval fortresses, attracting many tourists, especially during summer. The annual medieval festival is perhaps one of the best times to visit and to enjoy 3 days of historic celebrations, open air theatres, folk concerts and night parades. Christina Tiberian from Radio Romania International caught up with noble knights and ladies, court jesters and strongmen.
May the festivities begin, announced the Master of Ceremonies at the start of the 2006 Medieval Art Festival in Sighișoara, central Romania. A few moments later, knights and princesses started dancing to the sound of medieval music that filled the 700-year-old fortress. Mihai is a 25-year-old student turned knight.
I went to the stables, took my horse and came straight over, because I heard there are quite a few noblemen from my time in town.
I met Mihai while he was busily trying to find himself a princess whose hand he could ask in marriage. A medieval 3-day marriage, that is, because that's how long a marriage certificate is valid for at the Sighișoara Medieval Art Festival. On the first day alone, over 300 couples tied the knot, committing themselves to loving, honoring and comforting each other, forsaking all others, for 3 days. I wandered through the cobbled streets watching knights valiantly handling their swords, musicians masterfully playing their instruments, and actors skillfully imitating historical characters. I ran into 19-year-old Amalia, who was having quite a tough time walking in her medieval gown, the hems dragging along the ground. It's certainly not the outfit she, or any real princess for that matter, is used to wearing on a daily basis nowadays.
I came all the way from Sibiu to participate in the festival. It's so much harder to be a princess in the 21st century in 2006.
Hard as it might be, how often do you get the chance to participate in a medieval costume parade and be admired by as many as 20,000 people? Most of them were from Romania, but some had come from as far as Italy or Greece to watch the show, and everybody certainly seemed to enjoy it. We love the parade, and we've come here every year for the past 6 years, says 40-year-old Ruminița. And after a whole day of concerts, parades and theatre shows, shopping was a nice way to wrap up the evening. From handmade jewellery and goblets, embroidered shirts and gowns, to souvenirs of all sorts, everything was on sale. But not everyone could afford to do shopping. I ran into some hippie students who had no money left to return to their hometown. Romanians, however, are known to be very resourceful. So the solution came right away. Compliments and kisses for sale. For only 1 leu, that is about 30 euro cents, any lady could choose between a compliment and a kiss on the cheek. After 3 days of singing and dancing, the knights and princesses, rich and poor, returned to being commoners. Until next year, of course, when they get back their titles and make merry once more at the 2007 Medieval Art Festival in Sighișoara. From Radio Romania International, I am but a mere commoner, Cristina Tiberian.
End time now on the program for something new. We have a quiz for you and special Network Europe prizes to give away. So get your pen and paper out. Is this the sound of freedom? Just maybe I'm crazy. The world spins round and round. Ukraine celebrates 15 years of independence this month. But although the Soviet Union broke up back in 1991, many consider the Orange Revolution in 2004 as Ukraine's real break with its Soviet heritage. This wild lady supported the revolutionists with her music. Prior to the Orange Revolution, she's won the Eurovision Song Contest in 2004. What is her name? You can email us your answer. The address is contact@networkeurope.org. Or simply write to us the old-fashioned way at the European Desk, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. And perhaps you could also tell us how you received the program. We have 5 prizes to give away and will announce the winners early September. The email address again, that's contact@networkeurope.org. Or visit our website at networkeurope.org. We'd like to hear from you. Network Europe receives funding from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Slovak Radio, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, Radio Ukraine and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Barbara Gruber. Thanks for tuning in.